All right. Welcome to our podcast number 12. Today we are going to be talking with Paul Varges. He is the brains behind the Pontiac Fiero price guide that is published every year through Fiero Focus. So before we dive into that, I just want to say thank you to everybody who joins us in our podcasts. I really do hope that you guys like them. We've been getting some positive feedbacks on these. So if you have any ideas or comments or different topics to talk about, please send them our way and we'll get them on our list. So right now we've got in the works, future podcasts are The Ladies of Knife, What is Life Really Like with a Fiero Hobbyist, The Original Owners Group, the Christian Sass, we're going to talk about Fiero Focus and the design and the illustration of that. We're going to talk with Matt from the Fiero Store. We're going to talk about NIFE's prize show Fiorama and how that's come about over the last 25 to 26 years. We're going to talk with V8 Archie and how he got started with the V8s. We're going to have a conversation with the Midwest Fiero Clubs and probably going to be a four-parter. We're going to talk prototypes with Fred Bodermeyer. So you can find all this, these future ideas and past podcasts at FieroFocus.com. We also have a blurb in Fiero Focus Magazine and on our two Facebook pages, at Knife Club and at Fiorama. So let's go ahead and get started here. Welcome, Paul. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate the time to offer some of my opinions about the price guide.
Thank you. So how long have you been a part of the Fiero community?
Well, actually, I pretty much joined it in the fall of 1993. It all started when in Money Magazine, there was an article about the collector cars that you might want to keep over the years. And number 10 on the list was an 88 Pontiac Fiero GT. So when I saw that, I was kind of in the market for a used Corvette. So I thought, well, this makes a lot of sense. A lot lower price, still two-seater, sports car. So I started immediately looking for a Fiero, and I found one in September of 93. It was an 88 red GT automatic, and it was with the help of our club president, Jim Holman. After I found him, to went out and looked at the car and bought the car, and at the same time joined the NIFE Fiero Club. I was number 71 at that time. So that's kind of started the whole issue of being in the Fiero community back in 1993.
Wow. Yeah, I joined in 97. So yeah, it's time flies. I mean, it seems like yesterday too.
Yeah, it does.
How many Fieros have you had over the years?
Well, I don't know what the current number is, but it was someplace in excess of 150.
Wow.
That I have bought. And of course, keep in mind that this now has been a 30-some year. Let's see, it's 20 and 7, so 27 years of being in the Fiero community. So I've had a lot of time to do all of that. So after I bought that first one, I got pretty intrigued with it and quickly found a second one that I could completely dismantle. It was a Florida car that had a lot of, was a T-top car actually, but it was full of sand in every corner. So I took it home and literally tore it apart, and to kind of get an idea of how every part fit, where every part went. And that's how I kind of learned a lot about the Fiero. So after that, it was just a matter of being involved with the community, being involved with things like Pennox Fiero Forum, talking to people. And then eventually people would call once in a while and say, hey, I've got this Fiero for sale. Are you interested? So, you know, it just kind of snowballed from there and rose exponentially over the years. So, but I've had just about every model Fiero, I guess, there is. I have not owned a Zimmer, which is, you know, kind of questionable whether it's a Fiero. But I have owned a Mira, and I have owned pace cars, and pretty much every model car, every model of the Fiero that was made.
Wow, and you were dubbed Mr. Fiero too.
Yeah. At one time, that's what I was called. I was on the cover of one of our magazines, standing in the T-top of my 88 Formula car. And whoever did the magazine at that time thought that I should be called Mr. Fiero because I was so deeply involved with the number of cars that I bought, the number of people that were contacting me, information I was giving out about the car. So somebody dubbed me Mr. Fiero. It's kind of stuck over the years, although there are people out there now that probably are more attuned to being called Mr. Fiero than I am.
You currently have an 88 T-top VHET. You still love driving that and taking it all over the place?
Yeah, I do. I've had the V8GT for about 8 or 10 years now, and actually this is my third one. I actually started with a Formula of V8 and then moved up to a Formula T-top V8 and then to the GT V8 with the Corvette engine in it. So I still enjoy it. It's still a fine car, still runs good. It was a brand new engine, did a lot of work to the car, all new suspension, brakes, upgrades, just exactly like I wanted. I never built it. People always say, well, what will it do in the quarter? And I keep telling them, I didn't build it to take it out onto the track. I built it for pleasure and enjoyment to drive it around. So, and that's still true today.
Nice, nice. Not only do you do the Fiero price guide, but you also write an article in Fiero Focus called Paul's Product Reviews. Do you like testing and reviewing new products that come out?
Well, the whole idea is to bring products to the Fiero community that maybe some people don't know about or that are new to the community where people just haven't realized these products are available. So I'm on the lookout always for something new and different by many of our vendors. And so I go to them and say, do you have some new products? Is there something you want me to take a look at, review it, and in many cases be able to take a sample of it and test it? So I hope that provides a little information to the Fiero community of what's really available out there.
Is it most of the stuff that you see and test and review, is it more of restoration parts or modification kind of style parts?
It could be either, but restoration parts are probably 50%, and then upgrades and various things, let's say upholsteries and things like that. But most of it is just replacement of original equipment with something that performs better and will last longer.
Okay. Awesome. And we do have past Paul's product reviews on FierroFocus.com. So if anybody's interested in some of those past reviews on parts and stuff, you can always go to the website and check them out. So everyone's heard of Rodney Dickman. Everybody's purchased parts and other things from Rodney Dickman. But did you know he now has brand new undercarriage coolant tubes? Well, let's give a little backstory. The replacement undercar coolant tube story started back in 1984 when the Fiero first hit the streets. Some Fiero owners eventually needed replacement undercar coolant tubes. Many times the problem started at the repair shops. They put the pads under the tubes, and as the car was lifted, it dented and or crushed most of the tubes along as it was being lifted. After they were no longer available from GM, if they even ever were, one could only search for a good one at a junkyard or somebody else who has some of the parts. Good used ones could be found, but if you did, they were too large to ship. The post office, FedEx, UPS wouldn't even ship them, not even Greyhound. Another problem was the undercarriage corrosion under the clamps. A big problem in the 84 to 87 was that they go up and over the front suspension. Even if you put the 84 87 up on the rack, you still had to maneuver around the front suspension. Sometimes you even had to remove the front suspension. So, Rodney Dickman had been asked many times over the past 20 plus years for replacement coolant tubes. His response was, I was always told the same thing. Good ones
and used ones are out there, but they're too big to ship. So, fast forward to today, and you will still find that good ones are now very difficult to find, and when you find them, still hard to ship. So, the only idea that Rodney Dickman had was he contacted a few Fiero people that have worked on parts and or parted out Fieros. They talked, and all these new undercar coolant tubes, they told him, these tubes are generally never damaged where they bend inward behind the front wheels and go forward. The damage is always along the sides and the back. So, Rodney Dickman developed these repair kits. You can cut your existing tubes and install this 304 stainless steel repair section. So, this thorn in everyone's side now on these coolant replacement tubes is now a thing of the past. To order one, you can visit www.rodneydickmanaccessories.com. Try them out. I guarantee you won't be disappointed.
All right, well, let's dive into the Fiero Price Guide. When did the first Fiero Price Guide debut?
Actually, it debuted in 1996, so it's about 24 years old now. I start putting it together right after I bought my first couple of Fieros, just to get an idea of what cars are selling for, because I was so actively involved with buying and selling that I had a good history of what was going on with Fieros that were for sale and what they actually sold for. So I really started the price guide back in that time. So initially, I came up with the prices. It took me maybe 6 months or a year to keep watching the market, making calculations, posting things to Excel spreadsheets of what I've seen, and then kind of just putting it together in a conglomeration of what I felt was going on in the marketplace at that time, and then watching what was going on in the marketplace that would support the kind of prices that I put in there. So I used as references, of course, Fiero, Panox Fiero Form, which is still pretty popular about selling cars, but certainly things like Kelley Blue Book, Craigslist, eBay, Auto Trader, Cars.com, all of those sites I was very involved with watching on a regular basis and subscribe to them. And as you know, in many of those sites, you could subscribe and say, whenever a Fiero comes due, you know, send me an email or send me a link and you know, you can go look at it. Probably the most difficult part has been to determine exactly what cars are sold for as opposed to what they're listed for. But I've worked through that through the years, and I feel fairly comfortable of where I put the prices in the guide.
Did you see a lot of fluctuation between those reference points, Kelley's Blue Book, Panox, Craigslist, eBay, stuff like that?
Yes, probably so. Probably the lowest priced cars I've seen came out of eBay and Panox. Kelley Blue Book and Auto Trader and Cars.com typically priced cars higher, and many cars on those lists were from dealers, as they are today, by the way. You can go to Auto Trader now and find Fieros listed for anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000, but most all of those are dealer cars who they claim are pristine, and of course that would be, you know, pretty questionable, even though they have pictures on the site and they talk about them, and they're touting those as a collector type car and appealing to people who might look for something that's a collector car at a lower price. But yeah, you typically can find the higher prices on dealers' lots.
Interesting.
As opposed to going to the forums where people are actually selling cars.
Interesting. What does the price guide consist of? Just 84 to 88 Indies? Do you also include Miras and Zimmers in there as well?
All the cars are shown in there every year and every model, and including the Mira. The Zimmer is not. It's such a unique, different car that's I kind of consider that a completely different category. The Mira is almost a different category too, but since there were a couple hundred Miras that were actually made, I did include them in the price list, and I do kind of watch mirror prices, although there's not very many of them sold and traded anymore. All the other, the makes and the years are in the price guide, and the price guide not only shows the model name, but it shows the number that were produced in that particular year. And then the price guide certainly has the total heroes that were built at a little over 370,000 for the year. So that's all in the price guide.
We know how hard it is to find Fiero parts. We also know that as years go by, finding parts isn't going to get any easier. The big box stores will never make new Fiero parts because our community is just too small. This is why we need to support the companies that support us. For nearly 30 years, the Fiero store has sponsored our club events, provided free technical support, and produced well over 150 exclusive parts that no big box store would even consider. So, next time you need Fiero parts, head over to thefierostore.com and browse through thousands of products that are specifically designed for your Fiero. That's fierostore.com, the world's largest source of Fiero parts.
Do you consider the Fiero a collector car?
In my opinion, after looking at all this
information?
In my personal opinion, I'm not calling it a collector car. I think it's considered in the marketplace a specialty car. They're referred to as collector cars because that terminology, I think, by dealers and a lot of people who sell them, claim that nomenclature involves a higher price because you call it a collector. But I don't see the collector car as, if you start looking at auto auctions these days and you look back at some of the old Mustangs and Camaros and Firebirds that truly represent some of the collector car market. I don't think the Fiero is in that category at this time. And it may be well in that category someday, but my personal feeling is calling it a collector car is not exactly right.
Would classifying it more as an antique?
I don't think antique. I still think it's just a specialty car that some people like the idea of it and some people like the looks of it. So I think that's about as far as it goes. I don't see it as an antique car, even though you can get antique plates in most states these days.
Okay. Do you see some models have a higher value than others?
Well, of course, as I point out in my price guide, the 88 cars, because of the suspension changes, have more value than the previous year cars. However, the 87 GT, the 86 GT, and to some degree the pace car have some value to them, because in cases of the even the 85 GT through 87 GT, there are a lot of components you can add to that car. They're all V6 cars, and you can make them a well-handling car, even though the 88 handling surpasses all the previous year's cars. So, yeah, I think the top car that everybody still wants is the 88 GT. There are only 6,500 of them made. They're still being traded at pretty darn good prices, and there's still enough of them around. But also, there's as far as GTs are concerned, even in 87, there were like over 15,000 made. In 86, there were over 26,000 of them made. So there's 17,000. So there's a lot of 86, 87 GTs on the market, which can be upgraded suspension-wise and component-wise and engine-wise, that make them still a fine car.
I'm going to throw a little curveball here. Do you think color also plays a price?
I do think color plays a price, even though the market will tell you that the color doesn't make any difference. It's just like saying, is a manual transmission better than an automatic? So yeah, color, especially where there are low quantities made, as an example, the 88 yellow car, the 87 blue car, those are colors that were made for 1 year. And in my opinion, they do demand a higher price. I have not put anything in the price guide for color at this point in time, just be another column to try to figure out if colors make a difference. But my guess is that the color could be worth easily 10% more in value than the price guide or the price that you'd pay for a different color car.
Okay. Kind of piggybacking off of the collector car question, do you see that it's still worth continuing to drive the Fiero daily, store it, or keep it as a low mileage car?
Yeah, I've always said right along, unless it's a unique low mileage car. I mean, I can't imagine taking a 85 Sport Coupe and putting it in a plastic bubble in the hope someday that you'll be able to triple your price. So the answer on most all cars is, I think once you get over, let's say 5,000 miles, maybe even 10,000 miles, you know, might as well keep on driving it because you might as well get some enjoyment out of it. We haven't seen the prices escalate to anywhere near like the collector car industry has been. So I think by not driving it, you're going to lose the opportunity to have fun with the car. And then someday when you decide to sell it, find that it really isn't as worth that much more than you thought it was going to be in the range of a rare type car.
Kind of going off of the storing it, not driving it, does it hurt in the selling price of it to, if you're storing it for so long and then all of a sudden you start seeing leaks and issues and stuff like that? And I'm assuming that that's why it really should be driven more. So when you do go and sell it, you're not going to come up with those issues.
That's exactly true. And again, there's people who have cars that they've stored for many, many years, and you can still find them once in a while, come up on a dealer's lot with, 500 miles or 1,000 miles on them that have been stored for a long period of time. And a lot of times they'll tell you, oh yeah, we've changed the transmission fluid, we've changed the brake fluid, we've changed the coolant fluid, turn it on and run it for time. So you have to question, did they really do all of that? Same thing of a personal sale from somebody who claims that they've done all of that. I had an example that about 1996, I bought a 88 GT that had been stored in a plastic bubble since it was bought brand new by this particular person. He had never done anything to it, and it had 700 miles on it. And I did buy that car from him, and fortunately, all the fluids got changed, and it ran fine and didn't have any of those leak issues. But I have heard many cases where a car is sat around for years, and all of a sudden you start it up, and all the seals and gaskets and everything have shrunk, all of a sudden start developing leaks. So it's not a good idea. I mean, certainly you can have a car sit around for 6 months or even more, and it won't be that much of a problem. But if it sits around for much longer than that, you're going to have these dried out seals. So it's not a good idea. If nothing else, you take it out and drive it, you know, a couple times a year, maybe put, 15, 20, 30 miles on it on the highway, and that'll keep things going. You even have your air conditioning compressor seals in the same kind of situation.
Okay. What I know, some people kind of get this confused too. What's the difference between looking at the price guide and seeing what that, would you consider these resale pricing, or definitely not trade-in pricing, but what would you say looking at the price guide versus having it appraised?
Well, first of all, the price guide, pretty much the way I've set that up is probably about the price that they end up selling for, not what they're advertised for. In all cases, and I was just looking recently again at about 20 Fieros that are advertised in various parts of the country by personal sales on Pennox, in a couple of the club magazines, and I was looking at the prices, and they're kind of all over the board. So the key here is that I'm trying to give some, the word guide is the most important part of the whole Fiero price guide. It's just a guide to give you some ideas of where the pricing may be at final sell, not it's what's being advertised. And if you have a professional appraiser come out and appraise a car, as a general rule, you will probably get a higher retail market dealership level value, which probably will be higher than the price guide, because the price guide, again, is a selling price. in the true market. So that's probably the basic difference.
Well, it's good to know. And I hope everybody, you know, kind of sees that and kind of uses that as a good reference point too.
Are you looking for that special personalized gift for someone? Bonter Solutions can help you find that one-of-a-kind gift. Anything from t-shirts, sweatshirts, drinkware, signs, decorative items, holiday items, and so much more. They can design pretty much anything you want on them, from pictures of your car, your favorite sports team, a pet, or any saying that you want. The list is endless. Minimums are just one of each of any item, and the best thing is, they do not charge a setup fee. You can catch Bonter Solutions at several Fiero and Pontiac events in the area. Fiorama, the Dells Run, the 40th anniversary show coming up in a couple years, and the 2021 Indian Uprising All Pontiac Show. So, feel free to visit their website at bontergifts.web.com or give them a call at 847-453-3290. You can also email them at bonnie@bontersolutions.com. We also have promotional item products that they offer as well. That website is bontersolutions.com.
What is the difference between... So not only do you do the price guide, but you also have a nice write-up that tells you the difference between your classifications of what fair, what's average, and what's excellent. Can you run through that real quick?
Sure. Well, first of all, going back at the guide, and one of the articles I've written as part of the values is that the price guide can easily move 25 to 50% from the value shown in the guide. And that becomes down to condition. And I have three conditions, a fair, an average, and an excellent condition on the car. And so I actually show all that and go into some length about what I consider a fair value would be. And fair means that it's probably got some defects. It still runs, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done on the car. Maybe replace tires, air conditioning may not work, might need exhaust work, there could be some leaks, brakes could be bad, tires could be bad, so and there could be some real rust in the car, and you know, as you well know, that rust is a real enemy of the Fiero, despite the fact that we have some plastic type panels, that the under rust in the frame doesn't go away because it's a Fiero. And we've seen a lot of rust in the rear trunk areas over the suspension system. So a lot of that is almost non-fixable without major repairs. So I start off with a fair value that, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's probably wrong with the car, but it probably still runs. And if I move up to average condition, it's probably got only minor problems. There's no major mechanical problems. Should be minimum rust. Maybe the air conditioning doesn't work, but the air conditioning is all there. The belts are there. The compressor's there. And nothing, parts aren't missing. It may need some suspension components, but it's still, you know, kind of an average Fiero that someone would look at and buy and probably have to put some time and money into it to really bring it up to an excellent condition. So, and then I go into the excellent category, and this is a car that's in good mechanical condition. The engine compartment's clean. Nothing is leaking all over the place. Can't find much rust underneath, as in surface rust. Tires are still good. The wheels all match. They're the original wheels. Emergency brake works and things like that. And plus, hopefully, you get some documented maintenance records are available for the car. So those are the three categories that I defined as what I consider under those three categories.
Okay. I'm going to throw another curveball here. I'm going to bring in Nick DeMonte's car. So he did a full restoration, correct? So he took it down to the actual frame. Is that something that you would consider in excellent condition, Or is that something where that would just have to be a personal preference on what that selling price would be because it is a restored Fiero?
Yeah, there's a case where, you know, as I mentioned in the price guide, that some of these prices can translate into 50% difference in the values. And in his particular car, it's almost like buying a new car. So there's not a category for the kind of car that he has. The category is above excellent and like new. And even, I don't remember how many miles Nick has on that car, but no matter the mileage, he's replaced most all the components, rebuilt the engine, done everything else to the car. So it's like new. So that car, you know, would again fall into the category of someone who wants a really, really great Fiero and is willing to pay extra for it. And that puts that car into a category that's worth considerably more than even the excellent value.
Okay. You have a nice breakdown of the years and models. Are the numbers based on the number? Are your numbers based on the numbers produced? Does that play a factor into what the cost is?
No. It's strictly based upon what the values are in the marketplace. So it doesn't really, because a car only had, it was only, let's say, 4,000 1986 SE four cylinders built, does not put it in the category of it should be worth a lot more because it has low volume. So I've tried to keep that particular item away from the values and trying to just categorize it by the conditions of the car and what they are in fact selling for in the marketplace.
Okay. Have you seen that base price change year to year, or is it somewhere it fluctuates maybe every other year?
What do you mean by the price?
So you're... If you have kind of what you started with back in 96 and use that as your baseline, do you see the change? Do you change it yearly? Or let's see. Do you see a change yearly to where you have to update it yearly? Or is it something where you see it fluctuate where it doesn't move for a couple of years?
Well, each year I look at the prices, and probably each year I change at least a dozen prices, and I do change some of the mileage adjustments based upon the values that they're being sold for. So yeah, every year there are a few cars in there that probably haven't changed. Most of those are in the basic coupe four cylinders, which really don't change much over the years. And as a matter of fact, they're becoming harder to find because so many have ended up in the junkyard because once they start having problems with a 85 four-cylinder coupe, there's probably not a lot of people who are going to spend a lot of money to rehab the car and get it back up to an excellent category. So the answer is I do change it. I look at them every year, and I'm looking back and probably making 10 to a dozen or 15 changes every year to the guide.
You have also on the price guide a few options listed. Do other options such as interior style, wheels, stereo, etc., stuff like that, affect the cost as well? Or are these options that you have listed, those are the main ones that drive the price to either be steady or decline or increase?
Yeah, my opinion is the six or so items that I have listed are probably the options that people look for on a car. There were few style or wheel options in all of those years, you know, except for the stereo upgrade, which I haven't included on here. There weren't a lot of other options other than what I've listed, you know, power mirrors, the sunroof, and power door locks, power windows, T-tops, and a wing. Those are kind of the major options that were offered in all the years, you know, along most categories. But I see no reason to add a lot of other options that, because there weren't that many more to add. There were no real wheel options until you moved into a different category from a coupe to a sport coupe to an SE. The wheels that came with the car, you didn't usually have too many options that came with the car. as the, from the base car. So the only other thing I probably haven't put in here is the stereo upgrade. And of course, the leather interior in 88, there were so few made that putting that in there, I think we're just, it's just going to increase the number of columns in the chart, which is not really going to change it that much.
Okay. As far as the mileage selection goes on the chart, you only have it go to 150, but we're seeing a lot more of the Fieros that are still on the road are getting up into that 200,000 range. Anything over 150, does that consist into a negative number, or
I think once you get to 150 and you start going up from there, it's all down to a matter of condition of the car. I mean, I have seen cars with 200,000 miles on them that really, really look nice. So it's pretty hard to put another category of 160 to 1 or 150 to 180. There's certainly some of those cars out there, but I don't think enough to create a category with a price determination for over 150. Over 150, I think it boils down to a buyer on, you know, what he sees in the car and the way it's been maintained over the years.
Okay. Kind of goes to my next question. Okay. Have you seen a lot of the higher mileage cars in that average to excellent condition then?
Well, if you say how many, I mean, again, looking online, it's pretty difficult. You know, somebody's advertising a car for at 180,000 miles and they have four pictures and, you know, and they want a premium price for it and they claim it's in wonderful condition. But until somebody does an inspection of that car,
I think I lost you. Paul?
I think I lost you on that. I can see you.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you still hear me?
Yep, I can hear you now.
Oh, all right. Okay.
So let's go back and redo that question. Okay. So the cars that are in that 200,000 range, do you see them being more in an average, fair, or excellent condition?
Well, if you see cars advertised in that upper range, somebody will post four pictures and they look good from the outside. And many times you got to remember that when they get in that category over the years, they might have been repainted. It depends on where they came from. You know, if they came from the West Coast or Southwest, there's bound to be a lot less rust damage. If they came from the northern states, there's likely to be more undercarriage rust on those cars. If they came from Florida, there's likely to be all kinds of sun damage to the interior. So it depends on where it comes from. And again, high mileage cars, yes, I have seen some that have been well taken care of, well maintained, and I've seen some that are just finally at the end of the line and somebody just wants to get rid of them. You know, I've seen some advertised, some GTs advertised for, you know, under $1,000. They've got a lot of miles. Yeah, but it's got, you know, all these things wrong with it, but I'm just trying to get rid of it. So there's there's a lot of that still goes on.
Do you think, and again, I'm just asking your opinion on this, do you think a lot of people like to see the reviews and see how the price changes year to year?
Well, I hope so. You know, there's been occasional discussion about the price guide on the internet. And there's some people who said, yeah, you know, I bought a car and I actually bought it at a lower price than this. And some people say by having a price guide like this, it drives down the price of the Fieros, you know, let the market go where it may. Well, the price guide, you know, doesn't force the market to do anything. All it is a guide for buyers and sellers to see where they start. And based upon the condition of the car and what they have to offer, they can price it however they want. And as you well know, most people who advertise a car at whatever price, there's always some negotiating left. And the question is, how much is left to negotiate those cars?
If somebody were to see the price guide and they were a first-time buyer and they went to a dealership, and could they use this as a reference point, or is the dealer kind of like the say all end all, kind of, this is the price.
Well, just like everything else, sure, they can take this price guide in as a secondary item. This price guide has been used for insurance purposes with accidents that have totaled cars too. But yes, the answer to your question is they could take it and say, listen, here's a national price guide that's been put out for a number of years, and here's what they think this car is worth. And let's say that it's a car, an 88 GT priced at $10,000 on the lot. And the price guide, based upon the mileage, says the car should be worth $8,000. And I would hope that the price guide could offer them some bargaining power by showing a sales manager or salesman that this is maybe all the car is really worth. So this is what I'm willing to offer you. And you know what a dealer will say, you got money today, we're ready to go.
Do you... Again, kind of going back to when you're putting all this together, so you got the different auctions. You've got eBay, and you've got your big Mecum and your Barrett Jackson auctions. Do you think that the bigger auction houses skew those numbers? Or do you think that those are the rarity numbers that we'll probably never see again when a Fiero sells?
Well, I've seen a lot of Fieros come across the auction block, and there's some that have sold at higher prices. And I think, you know, sometimes during an auction, you can get pretty excited about something. And I think a lot of people do and do spend or pay more for a car. And, you know, as you know, there's a lot of costs in selling and buying a car at auction. So that all has to be factored into what those prices are showing and what they're listed for. So, I think some of the auction prices have been higher than what I anticipated that they would be. But if somebody's willing to pay the price, it's what the buyer really wants, and let the buyer, you know, pay that kind of money for it.
Do you see, like, when some of these cars go across the auction block and say they reach a $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 price tag, do you think people see that and say, well, my car is just as good, I'm going to put it out there for $15,000, $20,000. And then you have somebody that comes with this price guide and say, hey, dude, you're crazy.
Yeah. Well, same thing again. The price guide is based on a lot of history over a number of years watching these prices. So, yeah, they could say that they saw this 86 GT just sell for $10,000. And based upon my price guide, it should be $5,900. So, and that's fine. And that, again, whoever bought that car or saw that car being sold at that kind of price, you know, would certainly want to reconsider what they're buying and the quality of the car and what kind of condition it's in.
Have you seen, or is there any way to kind of gauge the number of Fieros that are left? And do you think later on that would also kind of play a factor in what the cost of the Fieros could be later on down the road as fewer and fewer are on the road?
Yes, I agree with that. And the question is, nobody's been able to really come up with a number of Fieros left on the market. There have been some estimates that were made. I think I even saw one as low as 37,000 not too long ago. The only real way to find out how many Fieros are still out there is there is a system in the automobile manufacturers group where you can go into each state and pull up registrations for cars that are specifically Fieros. And I don't know that that's ever been done. The only problem with that is those are all the Fieros that are registered. How about all the Fieros that are sitting in people's garages that are undergoing some sort of a rehab that are not registered? You never find all those cars. My personal estimate is that there's probably somewhere between 70,000 to 90,000 Fieros still out there. Now, that's out of 370,000. But I can tell you over the years, I have seen and heard about so many Fieros going to the junkyards that it wouldn't surprise me if the numbers are that low.
Wow. Just to think
so
about
the question, that. So the question is, will that drive prices? In some cases, it will as time goes on, as we see the market and the prices on cars being sold start to go up. specifically, again, on the more desirable cars, not so much the sport coupes, but on desirable cars and the GTs and even the SEs and the Formula and even the 88 Sport Coupe. So some of those will continue, I think, continue to rise, where the other ones, I don't see them, no matter what the number of cars left, will ever really go up much in value.
You actually bring up a good point about desirable. Have you seen just over the years, you know, and just general question here, the most desirable, a pure, non-touched Fiero, a restored, or a modified to a V8? What would you say, in your opinion, is the most desirable Fiero out there right now?
I still have to say a stock Fiero is still... People still talk about buying and rehabbing a stock Fiero to make it look like original factory. And there's still a lot of people who like that idea. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of people that want to modify it, put different engines in them and things like that. But I still think the desirability, if you ask a true Fiero aficionado on what he would like to have, he'd say, I'd like to have a bone stock Fiero.
Yeah. Well, I've seen them, and if I could go back in time, I probably would not have modified or customized mine. But I like the customization, everything on my car, the drivetrain is still all original too. So,
You've done to your car what you think you'd like to have and how you enjoy it. And that's what all Fiero people ought to do when they buy a Fiero, is, you know, you're not modifying or customizing a real high value car of any sort. You're modifying or customizing a fun car that you enjoy driving, mm-hmm. being seen in, and be out on the road and like what you're doing.
Yeah. And I, you know, when I first got the car, I, you know, feel, well, you know, how long am I going to keep this? You know, am I going to kind of get bored of it? Because when I was just out of high school, when I bought mine, and to me, when I saw it, it was a cool sports car. And I figured, okay, well, I'll keep it for a couple of years and I'll trade it in. But I started tweaking stuff and, you know, customizing it, and it just... kind of every year I would do something different, and you kind of put your own personal touch into it. So, and that's what kind of makes it hard to sell, is you put so much of your own blood into that car. You don't want to sell it because it's almost like a part of you now. So, a couple final questions. If you were to look back at the very first price guide that you published, and now, would you see a big difference in the prices?
Yeah, you would see some, but not as much as you might think. Actually, probably the prices have gone up in my price guide over the years. So I think you'd probably see some differences, and I plan on putting together a price guide, kind of a history of prices and all the cars and what I did. I just haven't got around to doing that yet. But again, we're trying to reflect what the current trend is on cars that are available to be sold today. That's the whole idea of the price guide. Yeah. I can't emphasize enough the word guide, because I've had people say, well, here's the exact price it should be based upon your guide. And there's too many other factors, including what we just talked about, desirability, that mm-hmm. come into play.
Do you see yourself continuing to update the price guide? Or have you kind of come to the point where you've put as much into this as you can, and I would like to maybe turn it over to somebody else to continue it from years to come? Or... is there a formula that you use for, you know, to kind of help guide the guide in future issues?
There is no formula, and the answer to your question, the formula is watching the marketplace. And the answer to your question is, you know, if there's somebody that is really into this pricing scenario and watching it closer than what I'm able to do today, then I'd love to have somebody just kind of pick up on this and maybe come up with a new look on it, a new way of determining prices in the marketplace. That would be wonderful, and I'd be more than happy to work with somebody to transition to that kind of a change.
Yeah, maybe this will, you know, kind of persuade somebody to step forward, because, I mean, everything that you've said and that we've talked about, I mean, it sounds like it's a pretty easy document to update as long as you watch the market.
Yes. Right.
All right. Well, we hope you guys have enjoyed this episode of FearoCast and kind of got a little background on what the Fearo price guide really is and how it works. So, again, thank you, Paul, for joining me today. And I hope that everybody kind of, again, has a good idea on how the price guide works. And you can always find a copy of the price guide on Fearo Focus. It is under, actually, where is that located? I think it's on the homepage of the FearoFocus.com. If you scroll down, it's 84 to 88 Fearo Price Guide tab, just under Paul's product reviews. So you could find both those right there on the homepage.
And on the price guide, my name, address, and phone number and email is on that guide. Or anybody's always welcome to contact me in any way they'd like to. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that I might have on pricing of Fearo.
All right. Well, thank you. That probably helps out a lot, too. So, all right. Well, okay. Thank you again. And
okay. Thanks, Mike.
Yep.
We appreciate the time and hope that somebody will get some benefit from this.
Yes, yes, I do too. And it's always good talking about Fearos too. So again, right. Thank you to Bontur Solutions, the Fearo Store, and Rodney Dickman for this episode's sponsors. Fearo Focus Magazine, again, you can find all this information in there and our two Facebook pages. So if you have any information or ideas on future casts, you can email me at mkroyer@fearofocus.com. And again, we've got a good list, and it's turned into a monthly podcast instead of a winter podcast. So I'm very excited about that. And we've got a lot to talk about in the future. So again, thank you, Paul. And thank you to everybody listening. Have a good night and keep fearing.